Today we are interviewing Qigong Master David Silver to learn about the practice of Chinese Qigong.
Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Neil Utterback, that's me.
And Phil Dunwoody, that's me. Neil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Neil, where can people find us?
Subscribe, if you would, to Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and also LinkedIn. You can also reach out with questions or comments at thriveologylab@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we are fortunate to have David Silver as our guest. David Silver developed a lifelong interest in meditation as part of his Goju Ryu karate training starting at age 11. He began studying Tai Chi Chuan and Qigong and yoga in his 20s. He started YMAA Qigong study in 2001 and was certified by world-renowned Chinese martial arts master Dr. Yang Xuanming as a Qigong assistant instructor in 2006, full instructor in 2009, and finally a Qigong master in 2023. And knowing Dr. Yang as I do and you do, he does not give such things away easily. And so if he says you are a Qigong master, you truly know a lot about this topic. David Silver managed fundraising for the nonprofit YMAA Retreat Center, that's the Yang's Martial Arts Association Retreat Center, between 2005 and 2016, which offered full-time 5- and 10-year Kung Fu training programs. I was fortunate myself to go out there, make about 5 trips there over the years, totaling about 10 weeks of training. And that, for me, is really where actually some of my most direct Qigong experience came from. David currently works as a producer and director of instructional martial arts and health videos for YMAA Publication Center, creating all DVDs, video apps, and streaming videos. He has produced and directed over 200 videos featuring Dr. Yang Xuanming, Guang Yi, and Lou Reed. You got to meet Lou Reed?
Yes.
That is awesome.
It's a cool story.
Yeah. Okay. We might have to start with that. Wim Hof and many others. He is the co-author of Sunrise Tai Chi and Sunset Tai Chi books with Rommel Rones. He is an avid researcher and writer and has worked as content editor of books by Dr. Yang, including Qigong Meditation, Small Circulation, Meridian Qigong, and Qigong Grand Circulation. David designed a product line of wooden Tai Chi training balls. You'll have to tell us what those are for those who don't know. Made of reclaimed wood, working with a woodworking shop in Maine, USA, in various sizes and styles. He is the founder of the YMAA Cape Cod School and teaches weekly classes in person since 2006 and online since 2020, including regular sessions for cancer patients and their supporters through the Cape Wellness Collaborative. And he can be contacted through www.capecodqigong.com. We will put that link in the show notes. So welcome to the show, David.
Welcome, David.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, I got to start with the Lou Reed story as a music fan.
Sure. Yes, so I had been making instructional videos with YMAA for a few years. And, you know, I got into it right at the very year that, you know, the DVDs came out, and so no one knew how to make them, so we all sort of scrambled to learn how to do this, and we managed to get the first Tai Chi DVD on Amazon, Dr. Yang's Classical Yang video. And then I really felt like the instructional video medium could be a lot more detailed and feel like not only, you know, a follow-along video, but also sort of like a time capsule, like, tell me everything you know about this subject now in case this is the only video on the subject that someone ever gets. And so I started making pretty in-depth, like 4 or 5 hour long videos that were intensely instructional. And apparently Lou Reed saw some of these and heard about them. So one day I'm out in my front yard cutting firewood, a chainsaw, and my wife is yelling from the front step, "David! Lou Reed's on the telephone!" I was like, "What? Yeah, right." And she's like, "No, really." So I ran into the house and I was like, "Hello." And he's like, "Hey, David, I watched some of your videos with Master Yang, and I'd like to make a video with my teacher, Master Ren Guangyi." Lu was an extremely serious Chen style Tai Chi practitioner. In fact, his partner, Laurie Anderson, said at the moment of his death, he was laying on a chair in their backyard just with his hands going through the Chen style form. So it became his life to practice. And to the degree where he would take Grandmaster Ren Guangyi on tour with him to do a Chen style performance on stage during one of the extended guitar freakouts that Lu did, just to try to get some people excited about Tai Chi, give them an experience of it, let them know that it existed. And he, I was like, "I would love to make this video with Master Ren, but it would be better if you narrate it and do the music."
Oh, nice.
So I was like, And he was like, "Yeah, I'll do that." He had just actually finished a meditation album of all synthesizer, like just crazy synthesizer music that he envisioned being for meditation and Tai Chi practice. So we quickly put this thing together, and I went to Central Park in New York City. We got permits to film there, which is a crazy place, beautiful place to film. Immediately when we get there, we said our introductions. We had a meeting the day before and just hung out and chatted, and I dropped like, "Oh, I loved like metal machine music." And he's like, "Oh, you like that stuff?" And I was like, "Yeah, my first band in high school used to play White Light. I'm a super fan from olden days." So just to impress upon him that I knew his stuff. But we get to Central Park, and immediately police show up. And they're like, "You can't film here." And I was like, "Oh, we have permits." And he was like, "Yeah, but you can't put your tripod on the grass." And I was like, "Well, what is the permit for if you can't put a tripod down to film with?" And it's just a weird thing that, yeah, you can film in Central Park, but you cannot put tripods into the grass or onto the grass.
Okay.
So we had to do this in this bizarre way where we were only allowed to have a tripod on the sidewalk facing the park. And then I had another camera actually poised up on top of a boulder precariously with this like $25,000 camera teetering to get a side angle, because we will always want to, you know, present like a multi-angle view so people can learn. And then, you know, we had written a script. Lou and I together had written this sort of intro script that is like, Chen Tai Chi is the system of practice where doctors and martial artists came together to create this form, blah, blah, blah. And on the way into town, he's like, "So how are we doing this?" And I was like, we'll just put a lav mic on you at the shoot with something beautiful in the background and capture your audio, you know, on the same day. And he's like, "You're not recording my voice with a lav mic." And I was like, oh, it's like this. Okay. So fortunately I had a producer friend in New York City, and I was like, "Hey, do you want to record Lou Reed tomorrow?" And he was like, "Oh my God, what?" And he had to drop everything. And I was like, and he's really like, I found out he's like an incredible technophile. Like, he knew more about the cameras than our camera guy. And he knew more about the lens.
Right. So bring your nicest microphone.
So fortunately, this producer, who's an old friend of mine, bandmate, Joel Hamilton, knew a guy who had the actual same microphone that Lou Reed had used in like 1972. And he brought it to this session that we managed to book in one day in like a bulletproof case and opened it for Lou's approval. And he was like, oh yeah, this microphone, I remember. So we were in his good graces. And I still have the raw audio of recording his intro thing where he's dropping F-bombs every like half sentence. And at one point he's like, the origin of Tai Chi is blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that whole thing was perfect. Could we just grab one word? Will you just say the origin of Tai Chi? And he's like, yeah, the origin of Tai Chi is blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm sorry, but will you just say the origin of Tai Chi? And he's like, David, I say it my way and you're from Boston. He refused. He would not. And so the introduction is him standing there doing this intro with a lav mic, but then we had to take the audio and piece together sentences, literally four words at a time, for the entire introduction of this.
And do you edit out all the F-bombs?
We did, but I'm super tempted to drop like an electronic music track by Lou Reed that's just all the F-bombs.
I think we need the unedited director's cut.
Yeah. Anyway,
I know
it was ultimately an honor to work with Master Ren, who's a great teacher, and it was very cool to learn about Lou's incredible passion for Tai Chi.
Yeah, which is very long standing. I mean, he's done a lot to try and kind of promote it, and I know it's a pretty dedicated practitioner.
Yeah.
For the uninitiated, because you and I practice Qigong and Tai Chi. But a good place to start might be, what are we talking about? What is Qigong? What is this thing?
Sure. So Qigong translates from Chinese to energy work. Qi is the Chinese word for the energy in our bodies, which we now, you know, refer to as bioelectricity. And Gong is short for Gong Fu, which means effort and time. Any discipline that you put in a lot of practice to develop skill is Kung Fu. So it's the art and skill of working with your body's energy. And we have two primary goals in Qigong practice, which is to increase the quantity of energy in your body and improve the quality of your circulation. In Dr. Yang's lineage, he pretty much gets all of his Qigong from his White Crane master, because Qigong is also used in martial arts as a way to develop the body's energy circulation so that you can be faster and deliver sharper blows or blocks in all the different Kung Fu styles. But Qigong also came from monasteries and from a healing discipline of traditional Chinese medicine that goes back thousands of years. My personal Qigong training, beyond the YMAA curriculum, has also invariably tied back to traditional Buddhism and has really developed in that direction, like post-curriculum, learning that so many of these skills that we refer to nowadays as Qigong or even, you know, modern yoga can be found in traditional Buddhism.
And one of the things Phil and I were talking about the other day, and talking about the origin of things, I've always fascinated when, you know, different cultures, different populations start to tap into some common features of the human experience and how they might have gotten, like you just brought up, sort of yoga and mindfulness, which we tend to sort of group. And here we have Qigong and Tai Chi as sort of a grouping. And, you know, in your bio, you also said you worked with Wim Hof, and I do Wim Hof as my own principal breath work. And can you talk a little bit about like how some of these different modalities might be different, similar, what they might be sort of speaking to?
Some can work together because, you know, the physiology of the body is the same. Some don't work together. some modalities will work for one person and not for the other. For instance, you know, Wim Hof is on a docuseries about like superhuman skills that can develop out of like long-term training. But personally, the Wim Hof method didn't work for me. I found it too overstimulating for my nervous system. But everyone's different. People are more different than we realize. You know, people have to find what works for them and their health as it stands today. And that can sometimes be like a moving target. So the yoga that you did 20 years ago may not really resonate or do much for you nowadays. You know, you have to keep, it's an active process of using these modalities, finding the one that you feel results from, not just like doing a routine and assuming the results are there, but you have to actually be really engaged with the feeling of the practice.
Yeah, I mean, these are very introspective practices. You're doing them to cultivate some feeling, and exploring that, deepening that feeling over time. So yeah, just because you're following steps doesn't mean it's necessarily working for you. So I think there is definitely a lot of self-exploration. And in my own path, I really kind of started with Qigong through Dr. Yang's materials and my time at the YMA Retreat Center. And then Neil and I both went through a mindfulness training program, certification program that was really designed targeting college students because we both work at a college. While you can certainly see the Buddhist roots of some of that practice, it's kind of a modern secularized version of mindfulness. But you mentioned the...
Or is it? What? I mean, who are we talking about? Jon Kabat-Zinn, who brought mindfulness to the mainstream?
Yeah, it kind of comes from that, but it's Holly Rogers is the person who kind of developed the program that Neil and I teach to college students. And of course, we have our own practices that, like you, have diverged and grown and in different ways.
Yeah. One thing I've become fascinated with recently is this discovery. I know you guys are familiar with the Mind and Life Institute, which is this ongoing dialogue between the Dalai Lama and researchers in psychology and brain physiology and cutting-edge brain research. Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness practice comes directly out of those early Mind and Life conversations. And so, you know, that road leads back directly to the Dalai Lama, the source in our lifetimes of the Dharma. And interestingly, you know, a lot of therapy nowadays that people end up working with, you know, for emotional dysregulation and all kinds of resilience and anxiety issues, whatever, stress in general, is DBT, dialectical. And that also has its roots in traditional Buddhism, you know, after her experience of misdiagnosis and being institutionalized, she became a therapist and then joined a Zen practice nearby and really brought all of that, those traditional skills, which are time tested and very, very detailed and, you know, lots of pith instructions and, technique-oriented teaching that you don't see in the like front-facing Zen or Tibetan Buddhist teaching, but they actually have like very detailed instructions about how to get out of different states of mind and how to address lack of calm and also, you know, things that sound like modern day almost like new age practices of like scanning your body, inhaling bright white light, exhaling black smoke. You know, these things are 2000 years old. So I always feel like all roads lead back to the Dharma nowadays.
Well, it's interesting too, like, you know, for us, for their college students, our general education, we talk about sort of ways of knowing, sort of epistemologies, how people understand things. And I'm always sort of fascinated how, you know, science, like contrast therapies of sort of ice baths and saunas are very hip and cool now, but they've been practiced forever. And now sort of, you know, science comes around. It's like, oh, this is a cool thing. It's like, well, yeah, we've known that as human beings for a while. But that how we can find our way into these practices and reinvigorate these practices for people in a different, through a different lens, through a different language of talking about them. And maybe for some people, the sort of the esoteric or the spiritual is not a door through which they're willing to go. And so maybe the science is a way that, like, okay, now I'm going to go into this, talk about it through a secular lens, but I'm getting some of the same benefits that I would.
100%. The, you know, Western medical science increasingly, you know, talks about like psychoneuroimmunology, where, newsflash, they discovered your mind controls your immune system. Or like, wow, really? Of course it does. Or there are so many instances where we rediscover something. Western medical science is excited about their discovery of ion channels, these places where streams of electrons can move through the body rapidly without resistance. Sounds darn similar to the concept of meridians and the energy body theory that has been passed down to us for 2,000 years. So eventually they'll realize they're talking about the same thing in different languages, and the East and West are going to come together. It's not a matter of like one versus the other, which has been this sort of allopathic approach that's happened from the 19th century, where it was like a fight between TCM and Western medical science, literally to the point of inspiring the Cultural Revolution, which was a psychotic, schizophrenic cultural outburst of insanity in China. I wrote an article about that topic that's coming out in the beginning of October. But yeah, they're merging right now rapidly. Every oncology lab across the United States has an adjacent acupuncture clinic. Mm-hmm. It's just happening because the data shows that these things need to be integrated.
Yeah, and science, you know, to part of your point, science also works in fads, right? Like they latch onto something and it's really big, and mindfulness has just kind of become ubiquitous now to some extent. And I was looking today, PsycINFO is like the largest database of psychology journal articles that are published, right? So it's only psychology, but still it's worldwide. It's a huge database. And out of curiosity, I typed in mindfulness, and there are over 25,000 hits come up just in psychology, right? So this is the extent to which it has been caught on and kind of researched. And that's a huge change. You go back 20 years, it was almost nothing, especially, mm-hmm. you know, 25 years. And it's really taken off. And the Dalai Lama's Mind and Life Institute, certainly part of that. Jon Kabat-Zinn's work's part of that. But then I typed in Qigong and used a variety of spellings because, you know, how the translation works. And 400-ish citations. And so it was interesting to me kind of how much research there is, at least on the psychological health benefits of mindfulness, and how little I could actually find published on Qigong, at least in that area.
There's definitely a lot of that work being done in the National Institute of Health, but more often than not, they'll just call it Tai Chi, even when what they're doing is Qigong, because it's the cue, I think. When I first discovered Qigong, I was so shocked to discover the thing I had been thinking about and I wish existed was real. And wait, it's like thousands of years old and there's this whole like modality. And I thought for sure that, you know, by the year 2025, it would be, you know, a household word and the most popular thing in the world. And, you know, I work at publishing. We've always had a sort of saying in publishing or a sort of walking belief system that Tai Chi is 15 or 20 years behind yoga as far as its mainstreaming happening. And sure enough, you know, after yoga appeared in every mall across the country, Tai Chi, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, really hit the mainstream in a big way, that you can't watch television without seeing people do Tai Chi in an arthritis commercial, or, you know, hear or read about Tai Chi. Actually, Men's Health magazine just did a huge piece about the benefits of Tai Chi in July of this year, and our sales have doubled. So it's really happened for Tai Chi. But Qigong, there are less Qigong teachers now in my area than when I started. And there are less Qigong teachers across the nation that I hear from in my sales position than when I began. And the topic is not flourishing. It is really, I think, because it's just sort of folded into Tai Chi that people feel like we don't need both. But they're really quite separate. So I definitely could have had, you know, five times as many students in my classes since 2006 if I called them Tai Chi or taught Tai Chi, which people very often walk in the door asking for. But I felt like a responsibility to push this rock uphill of just having the weird keyword and trying to tell people what it is and focusing on that. Because more often than not, people walking into my class were coming from a community-centered Tai Chi class where they missed class number 3 and they didn't learn movement number 12, and then the teacher didn't go back and explain it, and they came so stressed out and frustrated. And I was like, that is not how people should be teaching Tai Chi in the world. But it's very often the case where, you know, people are not experiencing a somatic intervention of relief and calm and peace. So I really focused 100% on that. And even more than the YMA curriculum really asked me to, because based on the demand or the need of my community and the people walking in the door. So my teaching just went in that direction. And then since there has evolved into this more spiritual Qigong angle.
Hey, David, you talked about, you said, like, you know, Qigong often gets lumped in with Tai Chi, but they're very separate. Since this is principally an audio format, could you sort of talk us through, if somebody didn't know what either was practically, like, what are you doing? What is it? What would I, if I wanted to seek it out, what would I experience in a given class? What would that look like for someone?
Sure. So Tai Chi is short for Tai Chi Chuan or Tai Chi Chuan, Grand Ultimate Fist, what Master Yang translates as the fist of the mind. Tai Chi is a ancient Chinese martial art style. When you do the form quickly, it's for self-defense. But when you practice Tai Chi slowly, it's a form of Qigong. It's a form of moving meditation. The fact is, most of us are not being attacked by roving bands of ninjas nowadays.
Thank goodness.
That was so annoying back, you know, a few years ago when those pesky roving bands of ninjas constantly attacked you going to the grocery store. But so now, as a result of this peaceful new situation, we can actually focus on the health side of Tai Chi, which is what most people in America, you know, the majority of people, 1 out of 100 are interested in the martial applications of Tai Chi. Most people are like, isn't that the moving health thing? My doctor said I need to not sit 23 hours a day.
And my blood pressure is high, or I need to work on my balance.
Yeah. I mean, or actually what's amazing is since about 2019, I started seeing and hearing this new situation where these 30-year-olds and now 20-year-olds are starting to enter Tai Chi and Qigong and meditation classes much more than ever before. I think, you know, their parents in the 80s were the weird Qigong people wearing purple spandex and the pioneers who forced this strange topic into American culture. But, the 20 and 30 year olds of today, it's been everywhere their whole lives. So it's just one of the other options. And so as a result, there's a lot of younger people showing up in classes looking for stress relief primarily. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if you guys noticed, but it seems like the world is batshit crazy right now.
Yeah, and there is no shortage of that.
Yeah.
And we have been seeing a dramatic uptick nationwide in kind of anxiety and depression among adolescents, emerging adults specifically.
Yeah, of course. That is the correct response to what's happening.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a dysfunction happening. That is the healthy response to what our civilization is doing right now. Mm-hmm. So as a result, we have to insert this stress relief into our weekly routine to compensate. And Qigong is really the ideal modality for that. So Tai Chi is this moving meditation when you do the form slowly. When it gets medium or fast speed, there's all this complexity and a wealth you can study for an entire lifetime of this additional information. And then Qigong, energy work, is either sitting or standing, moving or stationary, primarily internal energy work, where sometimes you're using your limbs in these big range of motion in order to sort of get your energy moving and maintain the health and functionality of the body. But the goal really is to end the session with more energy than when you began, because we get the chemistry of the body moving, but we're not consuming much of it. And then we learn through the practice to gradually quiet the mind to the degree where you're not consuming a lot of energy with the brain, because we know that the brain consumes 10 times more oxygen and energy than other cells in the body.
Yeah, I think it consumes about 20% of your body's total energy, which is pretty remarkable.
Which is not a small amount. It's like more than your cell phone utilizes in a day. It's a lot of actual electricity that has to come from somewhere. And people think so abstractly about energy that they don't really connect to it very much. As a Qigong weirdo, I have been so obsessed with the topic of energy for 30 years that I've really investigated what is this energy really. I don't want to know the platitudes about it. I don't want a metaphor about it. I want to understand what's actually happening on a molecular level so I can really get into it.
Well, I think this is where some of Dr. Yang's work has really been influential. And he's, the teacher that both David and I have studied under. And he has a PhD in electrical engineering, right? As well as this very deep Qigong, Chinese martial art background. And a lot of his publications are really trying to bridge that kind of East-West language gap. Hmm. And just in the West, we talk about, bioelectricity or, neurons or oxygen in the blood or whatever. And in the East, we talk about qi, right? And meridians. And how are these things actually just different ways of talking about energy moving through the body?
Yeah, absolutely. Finding Dr. Yang's book, I had been investigating Qigong for a while in the 90s, in my 20s. The books that were available at the time that I had found talked about Qigong without teaching it. So it's Qigong is this thing, it's from China, and here are some forms. And so I ended up just more confused than before I had read the book. And then I had a friend handed me a copy of Qigong, The Secret of Youth, which is where Master Yang investigates the writing of Bodhidharma at Shaolin. And that book, like all of his books, it's meant to be a self-contained thing where the entire history of Qigong is there. The entire history of Shaolin is that, he's thinking 500 years ahead. So every book is the only book you're ever going to find on the topic. And he's putting a lot of information in there. And so a light bulb went off for me and I finally understood the topic. And I decided to move back east, and because I heard this guy was in Boston, where I'm from, and called him up and I was like, hi, I'd like to, I just finished reading your book and I loved it. I'd like to train Qigong, please. And he's like, there is no Qigong class. And I was like, oh, well, I just read your book and I want to practice your techniques. And he was like, why don't you come down here to the school so you can talk further. So I went to the school and I was like, hi, I'm here for Qigong class. And he was like, there is no Qigong class. And I was like, all right, so how do I learn Qigong with you? And he said, you have to either join Shaolin Kung Fu or Tai Chi.
And learn it through, and learn it as part of those classes.
29 years old, so I was like, well, I'm going to do Kung Fu. I'm not going to do Tai Chi. He was like, you're too old.
Yeah, that's one of his favorite things to tell people, yeah.
How dare you, first of all. Second of all, I was like, well, I don't know, Tai Chi, I just didn't know what I was talking about, and I didn't get it. And so I joined Shaolin, and in Shaolin, you're supposed to gradually learn Qigong. And he was right. 3 years later, my knees hurt so bad. I was like, I'm going to be the worst Shaolin student of this school, or I'm just going to join Tai Chi class. So I switched to Tai Chi. But I also started saying, will you do a Qigong class sometime? And just annoyed the hell out of him until he started offering, and other people were also asking for Qigong classes. And so we started a Monday night class after school, night school. And then he also started a Tuesday night class up in Andover, which is about an hour drive north. And so I used to just attend all of those. And then on the weekends, he would do these intensive two-day Qigong seminars in 8 parts. And I did all of those 8 parts multiple times. And then I was also, you know, while I'm in my first day there interviewing, saying, okay, I want to sign up for class, I was also like, and are you hiring? And he was like, no. And I was like, well, I just moved here and I just have this really strong intuition that Qigong is what I'm supposed to do with you. And I don't have a job. And I feel like this strong need to like change what I'm doing. I've been playing drums for the past 10 years and I want to do something to help others. And I feel like this Qigong is like the thing I'm supposed to do. And he was like, okay, okay, okay. And he was like, calls over to the publishing company and he said, hire this guy. And they were like, we're not hiring. And he was like, just hire this guy. And so I blithered my way into a job. And then a couple months later, someone who ran the video department was like, I'm moving to Thailand. And they were like, who can do video? And I was like, I'll do it. So that's how I ended up with YMA 25 years ago.
Interesting. Very interesting.
And David, if someone was in your position in their 20s and they were looking for some of the same thing, where would you recommend somebody start today?
I feel like Lee Holden has a great program. Who? I always... Lee Holden. It's called Holden Qigong. He is a long-term student of Mantak Chia. Similar to me, he moved to Thailand, actually, at the time to train with Mantak Chia, who was the only other old-school Qigong teacher who was open. Like, Master Yang was open and teaching white people. Because you have to realize that at this time, in the 80s, 90s, Master Yang was still having his flyers ripped down off of the walls by the Chinese community because he was openly teaching Qigong to the public at the time, and there was still like an issue with that. I think that has finally faded. So Mantak Chia was this other teacher with vast knowledge who was openly teaching the public. And Lee Holden went over, studied with him, was a ghostwriter and an editor of Mantak Chia's books and really immersed himself in it, sort of similar to the way I really made my whole life about it. And he's got a great program of beginner and element-oriented videos on DVD and streaming that I would highly recommend. And of course, YMAA.com is also where I point people.
Yeah, so we've been, of course, talking about Qigong and Tai Chi, and I think you're right, some of the differences, right? Tai Chi does, I often refer to Tai Chi Qigong versus Tai Chi Chuan, right, to differentiate kind of that martial focus versus more the energy work focus, because you can be learning the pattern of movements and be doing both of those, one of those. I think Dr. Yang would say even the martial side, if you're not doing the Qigong, you're doing it wrong, right? That is inherently part of the practice. But you can study Qigong without any connection to martial arts. But all Chinese martial arts that I know of have a Qigong component of some sort. And it differs, you know, hard style versus soft style, internal, external.
Yeah, there's a saying that external arts train from external to internal, and internal arts train from internal to external. So eventually, if you train either one for 10 or 15 years, you'll get the whole thing. The external aspects of the physical body, coordination, and the internal aspects, which is this development of additional energy than the average person.
So this might be good. We've been talking a lot about it. And one of the criticisms you said earlier was, you know, there's all this stuff on the history and what it's about, but not how to do it. So if someone wants to try it, can you give us like a 5-ish minute how to walk through Qigong practice?
Yes. So I thought about this, and I think the most relevant thing to focus on is something that is actually considered maybe an intermediate level skill, but I personally incorporate it into all of my classes and all of the movements that we practice. It's supposed to be inside of your Tai Chi form, as you just referenced. It's also supposed to be inside all yoga movements, all sitting meditation, really all moving disciplines, ultimately. And it's this four gates Qigong. So it might be beneficial for people to just close their eyes so that they can sort of transition from thinking to feeling and hopefully get into a place where they can listen to their body a little bit more, because the ultimate thing people want out of their Qigong experience is not just to, you know, vaguely feel better or experience energy, but to physically feel the energy. So we're going to close our eyes. You're going to make sure that you're transitioning into slower, deeper, silent breathing through the nose, ideally. What that means is inhaling at least 5 seconds, which is slower than you think, really filling the lungs. Exhaling and emptying the lungs. Connecting to the breath is always the first step. It can be a great practice unto itself, just the primary component of mindfulness, and also, you know, Herb Benson's relaxation response is people getting out of their head and into their body, connecting to the breath. So sometimes people disparage the practice, but I actually recommend not only at the beginning, but at other times in your life, if the mind is just busy, you had one cup of coffee too many, or you're experiencing some stressors, or the world is completely insane. Counting the breath can be really helpful, even silently in your mind, inhaling for 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and exhaling for 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Because counting the breath means you become present in the moment. It's just enough to capture your mind so that random thoughts can't consume too much energy. because our goal is that we're calming the thinking mind down to the degree where more energy becomes available inside the body. Otherwise, so much energy gets trapped in the head. So through this repeated breathing, you start calming down the body. And then we want to see if we can connect to leading the energy. So if you can, just hold your hands out in front of the body, just lifting them off the desk or off your lap by half an inch, just enough. You don't want to lift the arms to the degree where your elbows are bent at 90 degrees and you're sealing the circulation that's passing through the elbows. It's more like you want the arms sort of outstretched so the elbows are relaxed, your shoulders are relaxed, you're sitting up straight, and your circulation can pass right down through the arms. And then if you bend your middle finger and touch the center of your palm, that point is called the Laogong cavity. This is a primary gate in the body where you're constantly releasing energy. The point, acupoint, is connected to the pericardium channel. The pericardium is a sac around your heart, and it's constantly releasing excess energy from the heart to maintain equilibrium in the heart's electrical activity. And so that energy is releasing from the hands all day, every day of your life. When you exhale, it increases. When you bring your mind there, it multiplies. So if you, for a moment, just bring your mind into that place, you can stop bending your finger, but be aware of that point and just bring your mind to that point. And sometimes just doing that, you'll feel the subtle tingling of energy arrive there. If not, don't worry about it. It's different for everyone. Very often, if people have issues feeling their energy in the hands, which is the easiest place to feel it, it's because of tension in the upper back and shoulders. So in our Qigong, we address that area first in order to open up the circulation of blood, nutrition, oxygen, and energy. So now we're going to coordinate the breathing with this point in the center of your hands. As you inhale, visualize that you're drawing energy not only into your lungs, but just into the center line of the torso. Don't aim right at your heart. Aim instead generally along the center line of the body. You don't have to be too specific. As you exhale, visualize not only are you exhaling through the nose, you're also emitting this energy through the palms. Inhale, you have to have a single pointed, focused intention that you're drawing energy into the body. Exhale, you have a similar focused intention through the palms. And one of the funny pitfalls of this practice is over time, you will feel it more and more, even if you don't feel it at all right now, to the degree where you'll eventually have a very reliable feeling of your energy in the hands every single time you practice. When you exhale, the energy is there. But a funny thing is that by bringing your mind to that point in the hand, it starts to increase the sensation there. And because of the sensation, you go, oh, cool, I feel the chi. Finally, I have a strong feeling of the chi in my hands. And you're thinking about the feeling, and so you're leading the chi into that one place, and then the chi is stuck in your hands. So ultimately, we don't want to develop a habit of leading chi into the Laogong cavity in the center of your palms, but instead through it. So you aim for a target outside of the body. Where your mind goes, energy flows. So you select a target a foot away from the body or further. Just visualize the hands shining a light beyond the physical body. And then when you inhale, you're drawing energy in through those points into the center line. And this connects you to the easiest to feel energy gates of the body. Anyone who does this practice a couple times a week for a month or two will eventually have a stronger physical experience of their qi. And once you have a strong physical experience of your qi, that's all it takes for you to go, wait a minute, what? There's something there. And it becomes this fascinating experience where the more you practice, the stronger the physical sensation becomes, to the point where you now have this verification of whatever skepticism remained in your mind. And that allows you to double down and really invest in the practice. And in my experience, there can be this slow, gradual increase of qi as you practice, even just sitting meditation or whatever your discipline is. Once you connect to the energy, it's always there. You don't lose that connection. But in my experience, the energy through practice will have these sort of major steps up where suddenly you'll be like, oh, now I feel the qi. And then it will plateau again for a while. And you'll be like, I want it to be like that last time, and I'm not quite sure I'm feeling it. And it's there, but you know, it's not that substantial, whatever. And then one day you're like calmer and trying less and softer and more relaxed, and boom, it will happen again where you have this major step up where you're like, oh. And gradually it can feel like you're squeezing a cushion or pulling taffy, or like trying to press two magnets together. And it can even be like there's a solid object between your hands. But you have to be almost in a semi-sleeping state, a very deep relaxation, closer to the limbic system, further away from the thinking mind, the periphery of the brain. And so that's what we're always trying to do, is transition into that semi-sleeping state where you energize the limbic system along the center line of the body. And that's really where this magic happens. And from there, you can connect to the healing side, and you can connect to the spiritual cultivation. And, you know, in the process, you're calming the mind, you're experiencing this breath work, you develop a good habit, to the degree where your body starts reminding you.
Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes this, you wind up conditioning your own body. What I've noticed over time, right, is I do these breathing and movements and the visualization, where initially it required, you know, kind of a lot of practice to feel anything. Then what starts to happen is, I would describe as classical conditioning. As soon as I start to breathe and think about that, it's like this, almost like this wave that falls over my body that I feel differently.
Yes. And
it is, I think it's the lowering of the stress response. You know, someone trained as a Western scientist, I came into martial arts through Goju. That was my first style, karate. And was interested in Tai Chi, and certainly the martial and the relaxation, but it was hard for me to open up really talking about Qigong in a kind of phenomenological sense. And I've gotten much more comfortable with that as my own practice has deepened. And you talked about the power of the mind. I mean, we know there's all this research on placebo effects in psychology. If you give people a sugar pill and tell them that it's going to increase their pain tolerance, their body's natural production of endogenous pain, like opioids and cannabinoids, increases. If you give people placebos and you tell them it's going to boost their immune system, there are measurable changes in their immune system that you can detect through saliva and blood work. And so we now have like this, you know, like you said, like this abundant evidence that, yeah, just thinking about something can actually have pretty drastic physiological effects on the body.
Well, the use of, like, whether or not somebody believes that sort of that light, that energy is some sort of external reality or it's just a factor of the imagination doesn't seem to really matter. Like it, if it's doing a thing, then it's real.
Right.
Well, like Dumbledore said to Harry Potter, of course it's all happening in your mind. That doesn't make it less real. Right.
Right. Yeah. Cause the assumption there is that your mind is not connected with your body.
Right.
Which it is. David, this has been awesome.
So
this is
great.
A great kind of, I'll say crash course into what is Qigong. And as we know, this is a topic you can go down a lot of rabbit holes for. We almost every episode give people a challenge, and your challenge is to experiment with this Qigong. If you've never done meditation, great. Try some of this Qigong practice. If you're more familiar with a mindfulness type approach, play with this kind of awareness of energy in a different way. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of connections. Something I'd like to talk about more, maybe in a part two episode, yeah. is how they're similar or different.
We like our part twos.
We like our part twos.
It's a topic you can spend a lot of time on because it's kind of like the big question. People are like, but aren't they the same thing or are they different? Or, you know, there's a lot of overlap.
All right. That is it for this episode. Thanks again. Thank you, David Silver. Folks, please subscribe to the Thrivology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have questions or comments, or if there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to thrivologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on, friends.
Thrive on.